find out what it's like to experience the world from above. Fly your own drone today. DroneCloneExperts.com specializes in high-quality, affordable drones. Now introducing their Limitless 2 model, equipped with a 4K camera for stunning Ultra HD clarity, GPS with precision auto return, and up to 25 minutes flight time on a single charge. Visit DroneCloneExperts.com now and enter promo code RADIO to receive 15% off your entire order. That's DroneCloneExperts.com.
Director and producer, and you're listening to Verbal Shenanigans here.
But our shenanigans are cheeky and fun.
Yeah, I mean, his shenanigans are cruel and tragic.
Which makes them not shenanigans at all, really.
Evil shenanigans.
I swear to God, I'll pistol whip the next guy that says shenanigans.
Hey, hello everybody. How are you? I hope you are doing well. Mike, how goes it? Welcome to another episode of the show.
I like your little nervous laugh.
You liked it?
Because it always seems like you come home from work and you open the door and our audience is like sitting at your couch. We're like, oh, I didn't see this coming.
Yeah, it's like the old, oh, hello there. I didn't see you. You know, that old film trick they do and the picture me sitting by a fire, smoking a pipe, something like that. Like, I'm welcoming them into our living room.
Our humble household.
Exactly. Yes. Exactly. So anyway, people, if you are tuning in, welcome to the Verbal Shenanigans podcast. I'm Scott. That's Mike. We are a weekly podcast. I guess you can call us kind of like almost like a radio show. We like to do stupid games. We like to talk about current events. And then, as always, we have amazing guests. And last Monday was no different. We had Phil Pritchard just in time for the NHL season to kick off. And he was in charge. He's the man in charge of the Stanley Cup. So couldn't think of a more appropriate guest for last weekend. Mike, have you caught up on any of the new sports that started? I guess we'll jump into a little sports for a second here. You had the NBA kick off, and you had the NHL kick off, and then you have baseball slowly falling apart every day.
Yep. My team got affected by that.
Yes, yes.
Thank you, Florida or Miami Marlins, for apparently going to a strip club in Atlanta during their preseason exhibition. Hence where everybody thinks the tracing is from.
You know, we had a guest on. I don't even know if we released his interview yet. Remember we were on the radio show, and we were on a couple radio shows recently, and one of the hosts was like, yeah, that bubble thing in the NBA is never going to work. The guys are just going to want women too much. Sure enough. What are we hearing?
Don Smith.
Yeah. Dom Smith. I guess, Don, I guess you might have got this one right, because the NBA were hearing about it, and now maybe the Marlins were playing into that too.
Yeah, I mean, for the NBA, I mean, at least they played it smart because they found out about the guy. Some rapper friend basically accidentally called him out on Instagram. That's how they found out. That's when they pushed the 10-day bubble quarantine on him. But this is kind of showing you, if you don't have a bubble or a really strict plan, all hell is going to break loose, because I think they're saying that with the Cardinals, they all went out the night after a series as well. So it's
Well,
I think you got to just find like places in the Midwest that it's like nobody's getting hotel rooms there, and just make it the bubble. Like, every player is going to hate it, because we're going to be talking about like Iowa, Nebraska.
Yeah. Yeah.
Something that you're guaranteed to say, oh, I can't wait to, kind of states.
Yeah. I will say I sampled a little bit of hockey, a little bit of the basketball, and I've sampled a little bit of baseball. I got to say, out of the three that came back very recently, I think the NBA looks the coolest as far as how they prepped the stadium. Like, visually it looks kind of cool. Like watching it, like the way they kind of had that screen like almost all the way up to the court with like some fans and some logos, and then the team seats are kind of cool. Like I thought the NBA pulled it off well, and then I think hockey also looked pretty cool. And I think hockey players, like, you never have to worry about them, like, playing hard. They just want to kill each other all the time. Like, it just seems like any playoff implications, hockey players just automatically go into, like, playoff mode. And then I would say out of the third, my third would be baseball seems to be missing a little something.
Well, I mean, let's going down the list. Basketball, I think the best thing for them is the fact that it's a very kind of small secluded courts right. that they use, so they can go, okay, with this more amount of space, we can design something. They can really, they have a cool layout. They have it where like fans get on the internet and they're virtually shown in a seat in the stadium.
I thought it was a nice touch, man. I thought it visually, it really looked pretty cool.
Yeah. I mean, absolutely. It's working for them. There's nothing wrong with the NHL setup. I mean, that basically just boils down to the fact that you're playing in a big stadium anyway. Yeah. So all you can really do is put up tarps and put some sponsors up and do that kind of stuff. So,
yeah, soccer. Soccer's been back for a while now, and they've done a nice job taking the big stadiums and kind of covering every seat in some kind of like team. Something to do with it, whether it's signs, whether it's big advertising. They've done a good job too. But like I said, NBA, I'm going to hand it to the NBA.
Yeah, NBA's got the best look. I'll give credit to MLS as well. They're down there in Disney. I mean, it's been looking good. I mean, they're having a World Cup tournament. My Union is still in there. I'm very happy for them. They're down to the I think it's the Final Four, so they beat whoever
Red
wins.
Red Bulls blew it the other day, you know that.
Yeah, so they'll be playing either Portland or I forget who the other team was. I want to say NYCFC.
Right.
Okay. I think those are two playing each other. I mean, one thing I noticed, like, I guess for like sponsorship, since they don't have quote-unquote home games, with each game they put like sponsorship for whoever was supposed to be the home team. So it's kind of weird, like, seeing advertisements for Acme when they're playing in Florida. I'm like, I don't think
there's
anything going on in there or anything national. I've been to Acme. There's not a good Acme out there.
There's an Acme down the street from us, and it's like our food store if we got to run and just grab something. We don't like it either. Not a big fan of Acme.
I believe you had a story about some like some person at the Acme where you're like, oh, what the hell am I doing here?
Yeah, they definitely have some kind of work release program over at the Acme by us where there's some psychopaths that work there.
So they're all doing it right. I mean, it just kind of shows you Major League Baseball and football went in there with no plan whatsoever, and unfortunately, I see disasters with both. You can make a plan with travel. NASCAR has shown it. They basically limit it. They're like, all right, we're literally getting there just for the race. You're not showing up for practice. You're not hanging around. We're limiting your crew there. It's literally get your car ready. Pray you got it right, because when I throw the green flag, you started the race.
The UFC has figured it out.
UFC has figured, but they, I mean, I guess we'll have to give them credit because they were going to like small venues doing that before they finally got Fight Island going. So, I mean, the people who came with a plan, it's working. Baseball just threw it together. They basically forced the players in for these 60 games. It was something like, well, this is a contract and you got to do it. And now everything's falling apart. Well, I mean, like we talk about the Marlins, my Phillies got affected by it. The Cardinals are getting affected. I just saw your boy.
I wanted to bring him up. That's where I was kind of leading here. What baseball season wouldn't be complete with the start of the season? Some controversy surrounding the Mets. And sure enough, Mr. Yoenis Cespedes decides to just not be around. Just can't find him this morning before the game. And he just, they can't find him. Brody Van Wagening has a press conference. Yoenis. And then apparently his agent had to call in the middle of the game where he should be DHing, which is perfect for him to get a contract because the guy can't stay healthy. If he could have a decent year DHing, he might, get a couple looks for next year for a one-year deal. And he just doesn't show up, and his agent calls in the middle of the game and just says, oh, Yoenis opted out. Typical Mets.
It sounds like he was just like eating breakfast, and he's like, nah, I'm good.
Yeah, this guy is definitely, I loved him when he can play, but he's always been a little bit of a head case. That was a knock on him when they got him. That was a knock on him when they re-signed him. That was a knock on him when he got injured hunting wild boars, and he had an accident hunting wild boars on a horse or something like that. So the guy
is the ultimate. I mean, if there's any reason to call out of work, it's to say I was on a horse hunting boars and something happened.
Yeah. Also, speaking of the Mets, I can't believe I'm giving a shout out to Chipper Jones, but Chipper Jones apparently bought one of the cardboard cutouts in Shea Stadium. So it's just Chipper Jones sitting in the Mets seats, and it's just level 10 Chipper Jones trolling. If you know, Chipper Jones caused the Mets just havoc for 20 years of his career and just murdered them. He was very close to, I'm trying to think of the Philly guy that's in my head and I can't remember his name. Just murdered Utley? The. No. Well, Utley did plenty of damage, but I would remember him.
Burrell.
Yes, Pat Burrell. Pat murdered Burrell. The Mets. Just murdered them. Just feasted on the Mets. And so now, if you're the Mets, I'm kind of happy they let him in because I think I love that kind of like playful, like, you know. But it is it's also like kind of like that B level team mentality. Yeah, we're gonna let our enemy in and celebrate him and have him staring at us in the cardboard cutouts. But the Mets just get it wrong over and over again, man.
Out of curiosity, how much do those cutouts cost?
$86. I almost bought one, but we're kind of tight on funds right now, especially with a baby coming. I couldn't justify, but it all goes to charity. So
it does. Okay. Yeah. Is it $86 for the entire season?
That's a good question. I would think so. I mean, I can't imagine they have so many orders that they're, filling seats, filling cardboard seats all season.
You think there's like a scalper at the stadium who's like, no, I can get you cut out in for $30. It's cool. It's legit.
He's got some ghetto like photo booth set up. Yeah.
Come into my cousin's van here. We'll take a quick picture. You're going to be in, I swear, the best seats in the house.
Hey, man.
You see your cutout in, like, the 400 section.
Hey, man, you want cardboard cutout? I got the iPhone. I got cardboard cutout. What you want? What you want? it just every season the Mets have to do – something has to happen where you're just like, this team, man. And, of course, they start, whatever it is, 3-6 or something like that. Just typical way to just get the fans back down and be like, yep. We're back to normal here.
They always find that little, they always do the same thing, but they always find that little tweak where you go, oh, well, that's a little different.
Yeah.
You know, you still give me the gut punch, but maybe you do a jab one year, and maybe one year you do a cross. And
I mean,
maybe
we've talked
about
it.
When you're not looking, you get a baseball bat to the tummy.
And we've talked about it, but like, you know, growing up, I didn't think anything of ownership, but it just shows the teams with bad ownership always have rotten apples in the team. They always got issues. They always got the media against them. We've been talking about the Redskins the last few weeks. The Mets come around.
Hey.
Oh, sorry. The football teams.
Get those. Yes. Don't put those S's in there, my friend. You know, Washington football team.
The Jets.
I like to call them the Washington football team.
The Jets just had to trade their best player because he's unhappy. It's just the same teams all the time, and it's just bad ownership. MMA, interesting. I don't know if you saw, there was a fight over the weekend where a guy, he won the fight. He won by chokeout, and he wouldn't release the chokeout in time, got up, pushed the referee, and then the referee DQ'd him, and the other guy won.
Wow.
Yeah.
That sounds like some WWE stuff, yeah, yeah. Right?
Oh,
there.
My God. Oh, my God. He's turning.
Yeah.
My God. He's pushing the referee. What's wrong with him? It'd be great if that was like his actual plan to like become like a WWE wrestler. So he's like, oh, I'm going all heel tonight.
Yeah. And
Joe Rogan's trying to get an interview with him. My God. He's choking out Joe Rogan.
Yeah, he didn't release the chokehold in time. Ref tapped him, and then he kept it in, which is like kind of like one of the golden rules in MMA. Like chokeholds are almost harmless. Like the guys wake up 30 seconds after that, not even. But it's like as soon as that ref touches you, you need to end the fight. Like that's it. There's no more. And like Dana White even spoke out about it, and he's like, anybody who questions my referees is going to be fired on the spot. Like. There's just no place for it. So, pretty interesting, man. It's like, you got to be a real bastard to choke someone out, win the fight, and then not let go of the chokehold. It's a sad state of affairs, I guess.
I mean, I guess he can't say that I didn't hear you over the crowd noise. I mean...
yeah. I didn't hear it. I didn't feel it. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, you got to figure the island's in, like, Saudi Arabia, is it? Or well, is it somewhere in the Middle East?
The Fight Island events are actually over right now, but there's a couple different things going on. In Las Vegas is doing them still. They just had one last night in Las Vegas. Great event, by the way.
Okay.
But there was four Fight Island events in 2 weeks, so that was their whole big thing. Basically four, like, fight night / pay-per-view kind of things. And they still have Fight Island. Like, there's still going to be events going on there. So,
I was about to say, and can you imagine his feelings on that 20-hour flight back? Just sitting back thinking, like, I had the win, but that ref, maybe the ref was talking smack to him or something.
But you gotta understand, like, you go in that ring, there's one guy who can possibly save your life in a very bad situation. Like, you know, this isn't baseball or something like that. Like, these are guys that keep track of you, the way you look in your eyes when you get hit, the way, you know, if they stop the fight, if you're okay, if you're good to go. Like, a ref, that is such a hard job that is so underrated. Like, they have to know, and they get criticized so bad if they don't stop the fight in the right time, but then they get criticized so bad if they stop the fight too early. It's a really fine line. And you're calling that live in front of you while guys are punching each other in the face. We're sitting here from a nice camera angle with commentators telling us what's going on. You know, these guys are seeing, like, up close, like, every shot that hits has to be really kind of looked at, and that's a really hard job. Especially, like, to keep the legitimacy of that sport. It's not like the old bloodbath days. Like, this sport is legit and taking over. Like, it's worldwide now. It is top... I don't know. I know when you go to ESPN that the MMA tab is before the hockey tab.
Yeah.
Yep. So, I mean, it's growing and growing. I mean, they're also bought by ESPN. But still, the sport is growing massively. And it's like... You mess with the refs, I totally agree with it. Like, there's no room for that in the sport.
I'm surprised other sports you don't see it more. Like, yep. I mean, with baseball, like, you get a jerk umpire. I'm surprised some of these batters aren't waiting till he's like the first base or the third base umpire and keep on fouling off balls in their direction.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah, just aiming for him.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen it once in a while where like a catcher plays the whole "I'm going to catch it" and then just magically keeps hits the ump in the back. I've only seen it once in football where the guy pushed the referee, but that was a famous one. I'm not sure if you ever seen the video. Have you heard about the offensive tackle from the Browns?
A while back. Yeah.
Where Yeah, where he got the ref threw the flag and it hit him in the eye, and it literally ended his career.
Didn't he like lose sight in his eye or something like that too? Or
yeah, he couldn't play for like 2 years. So he got a good settlement. He came back for a little bit, but I think there was so much damage he really couldn't play after that. So
I mean, as a I've been pretty big in the MMA. Into MMA. God, I sound like an old man.
I'm into the hockey, Scott.
I've been pretty deep into it, especially over the last 3 or 4 years. I kind of watch as much as I can. I really enjoy it. But it's funny because you see the same, I would say there's a cycle of like 5 to 6 referees. You see them all the time. Now, these guys are like the elite of the elite. These are not guys in the cage fight in a Delaware parking lot of a bar. Like, they're doing the top events. So these guys have to be well-respected, you know? Like, so I'm completely on side with that.
Scott, why you got to discriminate against Delaware bar fights?
Listen.
I mean, that's my passion. You're like, every time you're like, Berlew, I just ordered UFC 249. I'm like, bro, I'm in Wilmington. I'm at some...
you're like, save the money, bro.
I'm ready for some real action here, my friend. There is nothing bloodier than a Dover fight, okay? Well,
the reason I referenced Delaware, I mean, I think I told you this, but one time I went to see... my one friend is really into wrestling and, like, loved it so much. He's like, dude, you got to come see this Combat Zone Wrestling. It's like a deathmatch tournament, blah, 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 blah. I'm like, oh, yeah, whatever. I'll go. It'll be a good time. The tickets were $20 or something like that. And we drove to, like, the middle of Delaware in some dive bar. It was in the back of a parking lot. And literally, guys, like, just cutting each other with barbed wire, blood just ever jumping off the top of the bar. So that's kind of where I got my reference point.
Yeah, I know those, like, backyard fights where they get the fluorescent lights and bash their heads in with it. And
the one guy, I think I told the story before, he cut his... like an artery in his bicep. He won the match, and I swear to God, he was sitting there on the top rope squeezing his arm, so the blood was just shooting into his mouth. Like, shooting into his mouth. This is the kind of savagery this thing was. But
that kind of reminds me of, I'm not, have you ever seen, like, ECW documentaries? New Jack. That was I'm not sure you know.
We just talked about this last night with my friend. That was the best episode of that what is it called? Beyond the
Something in the ring.
Beyond the ring. Beyond. I don't know.
Beyond the ring. Yeah.
Something like that.
So for people who don't know, New Jack was this wrestler in ECW, and he is the literal form of I don't give an F about anything. Kind of wrestler, like, he will just literally start beating, trying to kill you, basically.
Yep.
During a match, and they did like some sideshow where somebody couldn't show up.
Yep. And this, Mass Transit was the name of the guy.
Mass Transit, who proclaimed he was, I think he told him he was 21 because the kid was about a good 300 pounds or something like that, if I recall. Like, he went there because he did this gimmick with two little people. And so he would be this big, fat, 300-some-pound guy, and he'd be fighting two little people in the ring. And it was like a cute little thing. So they actually were going to do like a small thing for an ECW match. And Balls Mahoney didn't show up. So I think it was Paul Heyman who basically asked if the kid could go.
Yep.
He's like, yeah, yeah, I've done this a lot. Meanwhile, this kid is 15 years old and never wrestled a real match in his life. So he went up to, like, New Jack, and he's like, hey, I want to do this. I want to do this. I want to do this. And it pissed off New Jack. So it was a tag match. It was New Jack and somebody else versus Devon Dudley and this kid.
Yep.
And they literally told Devon, do not get in that ring. We're taking care of business tonight. And he slaughtered this little boy.
Oh, yeah.
Slaughtered.
New Jack. New Jack literally took forks and stabbed people in the forehead. Like, literally would just.
Oh, yeah.
And then he fought this other guy. He was pissed about the one bump he took, and then he went to like the top of some other ring. The guy was like, "I don't want to do it," and he shoved him off and basically almost killed the guy.
Yeah, he even said, "I wish I killed him." He aimed. It was a what was the name of it?
Dark side of the ring. That's it. Dark side of the ring.
Dark side of the ring. Yep. Yeah, it was. Was it? I forget the name of it. No, it's like a wooden bridge that they literally hang like at scaffold. The top of the building. Scaffold, thank you. A scaffold match. And it's all like a back and forth. And like the preference of it is you knock the other person out. But they'll put like a table that's supposedly supposed to slow you down so you don't die as you hit the ring. But New Jack literally tried to throw him to the cement end.
Yeah, yeah.
And the best case scenario was the guy hit the rope, so he only like did somewhat major damage. Yeah,
and the documentary is not this feel good, like, oh, New Jack was a piece of crap, and then he got better, and he's sorry for. No, he's still an awful person, and like it's just like, yeah, I'll kill people. I don't care, whatever. I don't care, and like stabbed everyone. His forehead is just one giant scar. It's amazing.
I'm going to call New Jack a good person because I'm petrified he's listening to this podcast and will try to find me.
I literally said that. I said that on my Zoom call last night. I said, I don't want to talk too much crap about New Jack because somehow he's going to find my IP address and show up at my house.
Can you imagine you're in your living room and like your wife's like, honey, there's some gentleman out there with like a garbage can full of weapons. Oh, crap, he found me.
Yeah, he's a real piece of garbage. I guess real quick before we get into our guest, speaking of MMA, there's a show. Now, I'm not a big TV guy. I watch a lot of the same crap. Like, I know there's these amazing shows out there that exist, and I can never like push myself to watch them. When I get into a show, I watch it and I finish it. And this is a show that just got picked up on Netflix. Apparently, it was a show on the Audience Network, which is apparently was a DirecTV thing, but they picked it up. It was from 2014 to 2017. It's called Kingdom. And okay. It's based around an MMA gym about this family and trying to keep the gym alive and all the It was Nick Jonas is in it. He's the which I know sounds crazy, Nick Jonas in an MMA show, but he's the youngest brother in it, and Frank Grillo, who you might have seen. I think he was in Captain America. But, dude, the show is so good. I binged it, like, the last 3 weeks. And I'm going to go out there. Now, it wasn't supposed to end in 3 seasons. Apparently, like, that's just when the network canceled it. It was a DirecTV thing, so they didn't have a big audience. But there's 40 episodes or something like that. And blown away. Blown away. I've been trying to get some of the guys on the podcast, like trying to reach out to the cast members. The acting is so good, and the show is so damn good. If you are on Netflix, you need to check the show out. It's like it dives so deep into all the characters are completely flawed, but you root for them, and it goes into kind of like the dark side of MMA, which we all know fighters are not the usual. Great people to be around. And oh my god, it has a lot of like actual UFC people in it too, but it's about this gym. I got so fixated on the show. Like, I love the one guy, Justin Tuckerton. He was in a couple shows, he's been in some movies. The role he plays in this show is like, this guy should have won an Emmy 3 seasons in a row. Like, he's so good in it. It's like mind-blowing. Remember the Juggalo guy from Always Sunny? He was the Juggalo. Mm-hmm. He plays a role in the show. He's phenomenal. He plays this like severely mental ill, like he becomes one of the roommates of the MMA guy just because he's in jail and whatnot. I can't give it away too much, but I just gotta say, highly recommend the show. I think everyone should check it out. It's called Kingdom, but oh my god!
Yeah, I guess it all boils down to if the right network picks you up, you're fine.
Well, that's what they're saying. Like, if you know, there was like a round table or whatever I watched on YouTube with all the cast members, and they, one of the questions asked was like, if this comes to Netflix and blows up, you know, and like people really see for what this, I'm going to go out on a limb here. Breaking Bad's my favorite show of all time. Loved Game of Thrones. You know, all the great shows. I'm putting this near my top five. Near my top five shows of all time. I loved it so much because I love the characters so much. But they said, the reporter was like, hey, if Netflix picks this up and there's just like a big, like, you know, a second wave of it, you know, like where people actually get to view it. Because Netflix is worldwide. They're like, would you guys do the show again? And every single one of them was like, we would sign it on the dotted line in a minute. So maybe there is hope. And even the writer of the show said, the last episode wasn't supposed to be the last episode. He's like, I had a whole bunch more that we were going to do with this show. But Berla, I think you would really like it. I think the audience would like it. You guys should definitely, check out Kingdom. So, I guess with that segue, Mike, I think we're going to do an old school episode here tonight. I think we're going to go, we haven't done this in like at least a year. I think we're going to put two guests on the show tonight. I think we're going to do a twofer, and here's why. I didn't put out an episode the last two Thursdays, just for different reasons and whatnot. We have a little bit of a backlog here, and this is like kind of giving you a little bit more content. So we got two guests on the show tonight. Mike, who's the first one?
Our first guest tonight, Scott, is a man by the name of Bill Foster. Bill's a retired superintendent principal from Texas, but he's moved on to become a writer, producer, actor, director. He's worked with the Coen brothers. He's been on Fear of the Walking Dead. And right now he's working on some westerns of some stories that he wrote, such as Showdown at the Brazos and Showdown at the Guadalupe. Plus, he's also owns a vineyard called the Quail Whistle Vineyard. So we're going to be talking with Bill on pretty much the 8,000 things that he did after he said, I'm going to stop working.
Yeah. So he fits right into this show because that's kind of the clientele we go for. So let's get Bill Foster on the line.
Where are we calling you from tonight, Billy?
I'm in right in Central Texas.
Oh, nice.
So, y'all both in New Jersey?
Scotty's in New Jersey. I am a former Jersey, and I'm down in good old Georgia right
awesome.
Now. So I'm enjoying the Southern life.
All the Southern peaches.
That's it.
So, Bill, I mean, as I look at your resume, you've been directing, writing, producing, acting, and this is all after retiring from being a superintendent and principal. Were you like that principal from like Glee or something where you're like always emphasizing, put on the big show for the school?
Well, yes and no. We helped with the theater department a lot, you know. But yeah, I had to organize, you know, 160 employees all the time. So I guess it could be kind of like that.
So when you were doing this kind of work, like principal work, whatever, superintendent, like, were you actively like still acting and doing stuff on the side, or was this something that hit you afterwards?
I was writing during all this time, but I published a couple of children's books when I was principal, but then there was a lot of, not a lot, but there was a little bit of kickback on the political side of it. And so I said, well, I'm not going to publish anything until I retire. And so I just kept writing until I retired. And then that's when I started publishing the novel and a play script I wrote. I published it. And then that's when I started my acting also.
So the books in question, these are like the Showdown at the Brazos and the Guadalupe, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So, like, give us a little background. Like, I mean, you wrote like you got quite a few acting and your author stuff is in like westerns. Like, what got you into that? Was that always like, do you have a family history with it, or you were just always enchanted by like the cowboy life kind of dream?
Well, I was raised that way. I was raised on a farm with cattle and horses and, you know, wheat farm and all that, and worked in construction too with my dad and growing up. And then, so we always loved that Western genre because, number one, being in Texas and growing up on a farm, is just that's just the way I was raised and loved it. And then, too, when I wrote the Showdown on the Brazos, I wrote it in the old John Wayne, Jimmy Stewart style back of the 1950s. And if I could have shot it in cinematography like the old days, I would have, because I love that old style of movie. But the Showdown on the Guadalupe, the first novel I wrote, it is a historical fiction, but yet you can go to those places in Texas and feel like you're right there where I wrote the scene. And so then after that, I kind of started trying to expand out. And I really didn't want the title of the Showdown on the Brazos to be that, but I put it on there just to enter in the contest, and it stuck. So, you know, it's so close to my novel and book, I was just like, okay, I'll just stick this name on there, and then I'll change it later. And it didn't get changed. So.
Yeah. Hey, it works, right? Yeah. When it comes to writing, are you like a – are you a traditional, like, type it out type of guy and have story arcs? Are you like, when it comes to you, just write it out and figure it out along the way?
A little bit of both. I'll get a little bit of an outline and go with that. But, you know, it takes you on a trip, you know, as I'm writing, I go on this journey with my characters. And some people tell me I need to kill some of my characters off to make it more emotional sometimes, and I just can't hardly do it. I said, no, I like them, you know. I don't want to hurt my characters, but, you know.
You're a friendly author.
And so, but on my enemies, I sure kill them off. So.
No. Well, it's always amazing when people give it that kind of advice where they say, well, you should kill them off, and then like you pick, all right, I'm going to kill this one off. They're like, why'd you do that? That's my favorite Why'd you do that?
That's right. I like that person. There's a critic in every crowd, that's for sure. And that's what you find out. It's really scary when you put your work out there and it's open for the critics, you know, and you can't wear your feelings on your sleeves. And, you know, you just can't do that because you'll be bad all the time, you know, because somebody's not going to like something about somewhere along the way.
Absolutely.
Yeah, the worlds are critics and all. So
as you're
doing your writing and all, what kind of got you into the acting bug? Because it's just like looking over some of your stuff. You worked with Pierce Brosnan on The Sun. You've been on Fear of the Walking Dead. You've been in a movie the Coen brothers produced. Uh-huh. Like, I mean, that just saying that out loud, that's some great credits and all. I mean, what got you in there and made you get these connections?
Yeah, I've always liked acting. And when I was a little kid in second grade, third grade, somewhere along there, the teacher went around the classroom asking everybody what they wanted to be when they grew up. And the girl beside me said she wanted to be an actress. And everybody laughed at her. So I thought, I don't want to be laughed at. So I made something up real quick. Because I was going to be an actor like y'all, especially John Wayne. But somewhere along the way, you got to make a living. And so once I got out, I was sitting there on Facebook one night and saw the open casting call for The Sun. And it was down in Austin. And so I went down there with 1,500 other people and stood in line thinking, man, if I could just walk down the street, you know, just be an extra to walk down the Western Street, that'd be great. You know, couldn't be happier. Well, I got cast as a featured recurring character extra, which means you're right there beside Pierce Brosnan and the rest of them. You just don't have lines. And so that kind of kicked it off. And then from then on, for the next couple of years, every time I applied for something like that, I would get it. And, of course, it's all slowed down right now. But I read an article that if you want to do that, take everything you can get, whether it pays or not. So, you know, I've driven a lot of miles for a bag of potato chips, you know, but you get your experience, and then that helps when they start picking.
Right.
You know, when I applied for the Coen Brothers movie, Ballad of Buster Scruggs, I had no idea it was for the Coen Brothers. I just saw the posting for Western with Men with Beards, and so I applied and forgot all about it. Too much later, I get this text telling me the Coen Brothers has selected me, and I, like, passed out. You know, I'm like, what? What?
So what is it like getting into either a production like a Coen Brothers thing or, like, Walking Dead, that going from, like, you know, getting into small time acting and then all of a sudden being on a production that's, you know, nationally syndicated and has diehard fans. Like, is it just stepping into like a whole new world?
Oh yeah, yeah. When you show up on set, you know, there's just 18 wheelers everywhere. It's just amazing. And in fact, when I was on the Fear of the Walking Dead getting ready to shoot my movie, I'm looking around. Of course, I'm not going to be near that big. Excuse me. And I'm sitting there going, how am I going to pull this off without this many people? You know, but it is very surreal, especially when you see yourself on TV and you know 3 million other people just saw you too. So, you know,
yeah, yeah,
can't be any more police lineups because everybody's going to recognize you. I've seen that guy somewhere before, but
right.
You know, I got to be on a Super Bowl commercial.
Nice.
And that was, we didn't know it was going to be a commercial. I just got cast to be a commercial and for ATB, a grocery store here. And then it started kind of rippling down during the day. This is going to be a Super Bowl commercial. And we was like, ah, okay. I was just a few seconds off from getting residuals on that one. So it was close. But as you build your resume, it helps you get the next one. And doing some of those independents is what really taught myself into trying to do it myself. You know, seeing how they did the things right and how they did things wrong. And I kept thinking, I can do this or I'm not going to do that. And so that kind of influenced me to start doing my own thing. And that's what I've been really working on the last 2 years.
Yeah, so you're adapting some of your books into movies. Like when you're doing this this acting on the side, are you able to like to come go up to like some of the like producers or people behind the scenes to be like, hey, listen, I'm doing a thing on my own. Can you give me some advice? Or you pretty much got to keep your mouth shut and do your job there?
Keep your mouth shut, stay out of their way. They've got other things to do besides talking to you. Learn by watching and a lot of research. And then afterwards, you know, you talk to people that you meet along the way off the set and you kind of learn through them. Some of those that's doing the directing on the independents, you know, get to be friends with them. But on the major ones, you stay out of their way, you know, because they've got more things to do than talk to an extra.
Yeah.
And part of that's because, you know, you think – you could have longed that 12 hours. They were there before you started, and they're there way after you left. And so, you know, they're putting 16, 17-hour days in every day for months on end, whereas you're putting them on 3 or 4 days a week or whatever. So, you know, you just kind of stay out of the way, let them do their thing and do what they tell you to do. But, you know, and it really, once I stepped on the other side of the camera and started directing myself, you really realize how important that is because you got 1,000 things running through your mind. And you got to have somebody there beside you. I didn't realize this, but somebody told me I did. And so you got to have somebody there beside you being a bad guy. He can't talk to you right now. Don't, you know, move out of his way. Don't talk to him. Don't talk to him because they're friends and they want to come up and shoot the bull with you or run an idea by you. And, you know, they're good friends, but you're just like, gosh, I can't talk to you right now. I've got 10 million things other on my mind besides meeting with you about the weather.
Let me ask you something. Like, I find this interesting because, like, you know, I do comedy and whatnot, and since COVID happened and shut down, it's pretty much dead. You know, I've done some outdoor shows and done some Zoom shows, but, you know, with comedy, the whole goal to that is staying sharp and getting up as much as possible, whether, you know, whether you're going to an open mic or you got, you know, 6 shows in a week. It's just about that repetition and those reps. As far as an actor / director, like during this shutdown when there, you know, there's nothing going, how do you like attempt to stay sharp, like as like in the pocket there, as far as like your acting or direct, like are you filming things on your own? Are you reading scripts or are you just taking a break like most people are?
I'm polishing the scripts. I'm getting my next script ready. I heard the quail whistle. We've got one more weekend of shooting on the showdown on the Brazos, and so trying to organize that, get shot list. I got shot list, my camera the other day. I'll be studying it. I'll be trying to organize. And, you know, I've got a vineyard too, so between the two of those things, they're pretty, keeping us pretty busy right now.
Oh, why don't you tell us a little about the vineyard, Quail Whistle Vineyards. Were you like a big wine guy growing up, or was it just one of those, let me try a new hobby out kind of deals?
Well, we retired. I was actually elk hunting, and we owned 12 acres before we bought this place, and we were always looking for something to make that small crop with, you know, try to turn a few bucks in out of the small acreage. Growing up on a farm, you know, I was always looking for something like that, and one of the guys sitting there at the fire one night, we was at the top of the mountain in Colorado talking about his brother had a winery and couldn't find enough Texas grapes. And a light bulb started going off in my head saying, maybe this is something I want to research.
For a second, I was wondering where the elk hunting story, like, I was elk hunting and I stumbled upon upon this winery, and since then it just stayed there, you know?
I was chasing an elk with a shotgun, fell into a grape bush, but then when I took a sip, I'm like, wow, that was pretty good.
It's kind of like that, but then, you know, I never drank wine until then, and so we said, well, and so we started drinking, and it gets to be kind of like a person plays golf all the time. We'll try all the different golf courses. After you start drinking wine, you want to try this kind and that. When we decided to plant the vineyard, we did a test on our water there where we were at 12 acres, and it wasn't any good, so we ended up buying this 34 acres where we do have water and sold that other 12. And so now we've got 7 acres of grapevines and 1 acre is fixing to harvest here in the next couple of weeks.
That's awesome. Now, I know, like, winemaking, very involved, you know, very dependent on so many factors, from soil to weather to, you know, whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like a huge commitment to be doing that, but also trying to, you know, get an acting, directing career going at the same time. How do you balance your time as far as doing that?
Well, when they let me out of the mental insane asylum, I worked as hard as I can.
Oh, you're not out? You're not out yet?
Oh. I'm on my one phone call.
Leaving.
Okay. Okay. But yeah, it's very time consuming, and I had no idea it was going, you know, we were going to get into the movie making business. It just, you know, I started out on this showdown of Brazos with 4 or 5 actors, and now I've got over 250 actors, and it just ballooned up. And, you know, I didn't want to do anything second rate or, you know, cheap. You know, I was trying to do it as cheap as possible. Don't get me wrong there, but I didn't want it to look cheap. And so in doing so, you know, we've got distribution companies banging on our door right now trying to get to purchase it.
That's great.
That's a great setup. Now, I was listening to you in another interview where you were getting, like, compliments from George Romero's son talking about he thought you were, like, on a $1 million project with some of the stuff he looked at. Can you kind of talk about what that was about?
Yeah, I mean, I was real shocked. He called me one day. I was on one of his shows, and he watched the trailer I've got on YouTube, and I sent him a few other clips there, and he's one of the distribution companies really looking at us, and He thought we was on a multi-$1 million movie budget. I said, it's far from that. It's coming out of my pocket, so in the banker's pocket. So we're just real lucky. You know, in Texas, we got in with some reenactors, and, you know, a lot of people are just trying to break in to movies as far as acting. So we got a lot of volunteers to do that. And then, of course, I pay my crew and camera and we have to rent a lot of sets, but a lot of sets we don't have to. They're more than willing to let you film out there. And so we've just kind of, as one, my second round of editors, I didn't realize it, but he said, you know, your gift is producing. I'm like, what's the difference in that and directing? You know, I'm still so new at it, but he's just amazed at everything we've been able to get done and get it organized. And I said, well, you know, that goes back to the school business of organizing all the people and making sure we do it right and fast and get it done. And so that's kind of what we've been trying to do, is just make it look as good as possible with as little money as we've got. And it's not a micro budget movie, you know, where the director's holding the camera and directing traffic at the same time, but it's above that. But it's going to be look like a $1 million budget, yes. So we keep our fingers crossed it looks like that on the big screen.
Yeah, I can't imagine, like, even getting into the like the Western film world would even start at being cheap. Just thinking of, like, you know, special effects and the costumes and the whether it's horses. I can't imagine that's an easy thing to do on a low budget.
No, and you know, I want it to be very accurate, period correct. You know, make sure all the guns are right, the rigs are right. When I say rig, you know, saddles and all that kind of good stuff. And so that's where the reenactors come in really handy. And then I bought lots of costumes myself, because when you know, I wanted to be an extra. I bought one set, you know, one outfit to be in those extras. And so I started adding to that over the couple of years. So when we started doing this, and even though I would let somebody else use my costume, I'd try to buy it somewhere where I could wear it down the line.
Right
around my size. Hmm. And then I've bought a bunch off eBay and things like that on auction where it's fairly reasonable, and tried to buy things like that, different sizes, so different people can, you know, different characters could have costumes that didn't have any. And so we've been able to just string it along and pick up things like that along the way. We've got horses, wagons. I said, when we were at a set, I said, how much would it cost you to drive your wagon through town? And he said, well, that'd be $200. I was like, oh, my, $200 for wagon. Okay, do it. And I'm going to shut my eyes.
Yeah. Figure it out.
Yeah. I don't know where the 200 will come out later, but we need that wagon horses driving through town. So, you know, but, you know, the time he hooks these horses up and gets his wagon and everything out there, it's worth that for him. You know, that takes an hour or two just to do that. So, and it adds to the realism of the set.
For sure. Yeah.
Now, being the writer of the script and the director, are you able to kind of look at what you wrote and say, okay, I have to adapt this fairly easily for the movie? Or are you one of those, I got to go by what my original thoughts were and this is how we got to shoot it?
No, we change it all the time. I tell the actors, it's not Shakespeare, and you make sure you feel comfortable with whatever the lines are. You can change them a little bit as long as the meaning stays the same. And then we go from there. Now, if you just keep, I'll tell you one example. One guy gave him lines and we shoot it. He says these lines. I said, cut. Let's do that again. These lines, I finally said, sir, did you not get the script? Yeah, do you want me to use it?
Yeah.
I was like, yeah, that'd be really good. So we went through it like one more time. I said, we're cutting that part out.
Yeah.
You know, he made up his own line. I'm like, what are you doing? You know? But, no, I give people, you know, some latitude there, but not that much. But, you know, sometimes it just doesn't work out. It doesn't work as far as whether you're at the set or the people you've got. And we thought we had it finished. And then, like I said, when I got the second round of editor, he went in there and we sat down and watched it real fine tooth. He asked me 1,000 questions that day. And so that's when we decided to go back and reshoot some scenes that we hadn't included. And then I needed to write some more scenes. And so I did that. So that's how we came up with 3 more days left of filming. We had 3 weekends planned. We got 2 of them shot, and then COVID hit and we got shut down again.
That's awesome, Bill. I love hearing your entrepreneurial spirit, and I love that you delve into a lot of different things, because I think that's what you have to do nowadays to be successful. No one's really doing one thing. It's almost impossible. So I really appreciate the time you gave us today.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Oh, anytime. If people want to check you out or check out your work or the vineyard, like, you have several things you could promote. So go ahead. Where's the best place to find you?
You can go to my IMDb page. And Shenandoah Brazos has an IMDb page too. Or you can go to my Facebook and check out there. And we try to put pictures from behind the scenes, and we do casting calls there. And so those are the best places. We're working on a web page where we can get information on our wine that's going to be coming up next year. And so it's all in the process of getting it out there. So those are a couple of places they can look and keep up with me.
That's awesome.
Awesome. Bill, one last question. Now that you've done all this acting and you're making movies and so forth, have you got, like, one of your kids from your school, like, chatting you up? Hey, Mr. Foster! Yeah. Hey, can you give me a part?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I put some of them in there, too. I've even put a couple of my teachers I had in movie, you know, as extras, the kids.
That's awesome.
And so, yeah, it all you network all those in there.
That's great. Bill, thank you for your time, and we appreciate it. And stay safe out there, and we look forward to seeing what you do down the line.
Well, thank you so much for having me. Be glad to come back on when the movie comes out.
Sounds great.
So, John, I was looking up like a little bit of info on you. It kind of sounds interesting. Like you're into a lot of different things: acting, DJing, rapping, improv, ghost hunting. From what I'm seeing, it all started because you had like a family member that was like very strict and tried to like keep the family in and like not have them like do much. Can you explain a little about that?
Yeah, of course, definitely. Yeah, that's kind of the dark past of myself a little bit. It's something I just came to terms with recently, actually. My grandmother was very abusive she isolated us when we were younger. Definitely for most of society, and it was hard to express yourself. So I found an outlet in a lot of entertainment, whether it was music, comedy, things like that. That's really where I got to express myself. So I think that's really where I got my passion for it. You know, when you don't have any avenue, when you're in your home, you can't really speak, and anything you say is considered wrong. Like, you have to find other outlets. So that's kind of, yeah, one of the main reasons why I think I have such a passion and just a love of, you know, all creative forms, whether it's music or art or, you know, comedy, all kinds of things. So yeah, definitely that's a big part of my story and why I love what I do so much.
What was first on the list? Like, what was the first thing you really tried to pursue out of those things?
Definitely it was music. Music was the first thing I started imitating when I was really little. I always was kind of, I call myself a regurgitator or an imitator. I grew up, you know, listening to music. I would imitate Michael Jackson's dance moves. You know, I did a lot of other stuff too. Like, I would imitate the Groucho Marx and the Marx Brothers and like comedians I saw on TV and stuff like that. But music, I think, was definitely the first one. I would always dance, love music, singing along to the music. When I went to junior high, counselor recommended I do extracurricular stuff. I ended up doing choir, and I sang in choir for like 6 years from junior high to high school. So music was definitely, I think, the first one that got me kind of that taste for being on stage and performing and expressing myself. And then it just continued from there, and I expanded out into acting and other things as well. So
One of the things I've seen you in recently, you were part of Ford v Ferrari, and you know?
That's a great movie.
Guy getting into the business and all. I mean, you got to play a couple roles. Tell us a little bit about like what it was like on the set, and for what I've seen, you were right there with like Shane from The Walking Dead, and
yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that set.
Definitely. Yeah, it kind of came randomly a little bit. I was focusing a little more on my stand-up comedy and music at the time. And I was, I would say, kind of a hiatus from acting because I didn't focus a lot on my acting at the time. But I made a decision to quit my day job in that time frame that I ended up getting cast for the movie. And I got a random call from casting. They found me on LA Casting. They said I look real Italian. They found out I spoke Italian fluently and that, you know, they liked my look and all that kind of stuff. And I went in for a fitting, and it just kind of grew from there because of all my experience. I ended up getting to do a big scene with John Bernthal early on in the movie where I was playing one of the Ferrari factory workers in Italy, and I had a little interaction with him, and it went really well. I got directed by James Mangold, which was another incredible experience to have such a big director actually, you know, come and direct me and do a scene with John Bernthal where I communicated with him. We talked about what we were going to do in the scene, how we were going to do that. And so I was shot for 2 weeks on that scene of the movie. And then there was about a two-week break after I'd quit my job, so I wasn't doing very much. And then I get a call from casting, and they're like, hey, do you want to do another month and a half of shooting? We're going to have you be part of the pit crew for Ferrari for the Le Mans races.
Nice.
So I ended up being one of the five main guys who spoke Italian, and we did the pit crew stuff. We did filling up the cars with gas when they came for their pit stops. Matt Damon stole our stopwatch, so we like, you know, went crazy.
Oh, yeah,
and we're
speaking in
Italian, and we're like, oh, okay, go to those, you know, and just kind of did our kind of Italian thing for the movie. So yeah, I got to work alongside a lot of those big actors around Matt Damon, Christian Bale, John Bernthal.
Wow.
All wonderful people, wonderful actors. Definitely, I say John Bernthal and Matt Damon. They had more friendly personalities. They would engage with you a little more and make the set really lively and joke around, make you laugh. Christian Bale is a very serious actor, incredible actor, but very serious, very in his role. You don't see a lot of his just regular personality because he's so into the role he's playing.
Yeah.
But I mean, still was very nice to everyone, you know, just was definitely there to do a job, and you saw that he was there to do that. So very serious. And then we were all really impressed. He had just finished shooting Vice, And I know that in that film, he gained weight for that role. So
yeah,
he
was
pretty
thin. He's amazing.
When he came on set with us, and we were all kind of amazed. We're like, wow, like he lost that weight really fast to get for this role. So it was a great experience being on that set. It didn't matter what part, big or small, you played. We all had a feeling that this movie was going to be something special. You just felt it when you were on set. There was just like, you know, when they say there's magic happening, we really all felt that when we were shooting the movie. So that was a lot of fun. And like I said, I did about total 2 months of shooting on that movie. I got all my SAG vouchers. So, you know, I'm eligible to join the Screen Actors Guild and all that stuff, which was great. And I just let it be a big confidence booster for me. Cause when I talk about the abuse earlier, it definitely hindered me a lot in my career because my abuser didn't encourage my ambition. They said they used God in terms of saying you're not going to accomplish things. They used a lot of their own insecurities to try and push on me. And getting that part just boosted my confidence. I got a lot more jobs, like bigger acting jobs after that. I did commercials and TV shows and parts here and there. So it definitely boosted me as an actor and my confidence. And it was an incredible experience. I'll definitely never forget.
And is it true that you and Christian Bale now live together in an apartment flat and you guys are like, you're working on a buddy comedy?
I wish. That's how I'm gonna plan for the future. if anything, my biggest scene I did was with John Bernthal. So we did get to know each other because we worked together and we shot the scene a bunch of times. So we actually got a lot of interaction and he was really a wonderful guy and we got to actually communicate. But I mean, I was definitely in close proximity to all of them during the whole time of filming. And you, like I said, you got to see their personalities and get to know them a little bit on set. But I definitely didn't get like, you know, we didn't have the same trailer, that's for sure.
Ah, gotcha. No, so tell us about, so not only are you into acting, you're into music and performing and whatnot, but where does the ghost hunting come in? And where does the ghost stuff come in? And how did that come about?
Yeah, definitely. It's another very big part of my life. And it's funny because I always kind of saw it separate from my entertainment aspirations, but it always kind of intertwined. And I'll go into some of those projects after I explain a little my history with paranormal. Sure. So I was about 2 years old. I stayed at my grandmother's house, which was a common thing, you know, frequently. But one particular time, I saw my grandfather's spirit when I was sleeping over at the house. And he had passed away when I was only 3 months old. So I don't really know him that well. I didn't have a lot of experience for anything to remember about him except for pictures that I saw. So when he appeared to me, I was very young. I didn't know what was going on. I kind of freaked out. And I watched him like leave the room and disappear through the dining room wall. I went to tell my family about it, told my grandma. She said, oh, you know, it's just a bad dream. You know, just don't worry about it. Just sleep it off. And my family kind of played up that story for a while, but I started experiencing things. And I figured if my family didn't, you know, understand or believe me, who else is going to? So I kind of shut down and became a little introverted about that kind of stuff. But about 8 years later, my family finally sat me down and said, hey, like my grandma in Italy had experienced a lot of paranormal stuff. My mom experienced a lot of paranormal stuff. And that our family's kind of sensitive to that. And that's when it really clicked with me that I really have an interest in this and other people have experienced what I experienced and I really want to study it more. And when I found out about it, there wasn't all the TV and media that there is now on the paranormal. So I had to like have my parents buy me books so I could read books and learn more about it. There was a few shows here or there. There was an old show Sightings on Fox that used to talk about like UFOs and ghosts and aliens. Unsolved Mysteries would do like ghost stories and stuff too. So there was a few places in the media where you could look it up. But for the most part, I had to like learn a lot of stuff on my own. Eventually, when I started going to college, besides pursuing entertainment, which I studied radio, TV, and film, I also studied psychology as well as parapsychology. And eventually started a nonprofit organization called the Southern California Paranormal Detectives. That officially kind of started in 2000 when I met my best friend in high school and he was interested in the paranormal. So we just started going to places, writing letters to haunted places and see if they would let us in. We started contacting famous people in the paranormal field and, you know, kind of getting them to mentor us and teach us things about the paranormal. And we just grew from there. By the time we got to college, we added more members and, you know, with sometimes using filmmakers to do documentaries and things, we got access to places and just kind of built up our resume there and did a lot of things. And it's one of my biggest passions. One of the jokes about it, which is half true, my mom went to see Ghostbusters like literally right before she popped with me, before I was born. And, you know, from the womb, I think I was a Ghostbusters fan. And I always wanted a degree like Dr. Peter Brinkman in parapsychology. And in 2009, I earned my PhD in parapsychology. So
nice.
So yeah, I've done a lot with it. I lectured at Chapman University in the sociology department for 6 years. Alongside other professors on the paranormal, what it is, what we do to investigate it, how we want to be seen more professionally in the field, more than just an entertainment type of thing, but an actual education thing on the paranormal. So that's kind of a quick breakdown of some of the stuff I've done and why I got into it, and I'm so passionate about it.
That's awesome.
Now, how do you balance everything that you have? Are you just going by what's kind of like the hot thing at the moment? Is it going by what interests you at the moment? What drives you to say, okay, I'm gonna DJ this week or act this week or improv or so forth?
Yeah, I think you said it perfectly. You actually took the words right out of my mouth. It's kind of whatever's hitting at the time. Certain things just take precedence over other things at certain times, and that's kind of how it works. I think it's beneficial for me to be so versatile, because if one thing's not working, usually there's opportunity in other areas.
For sure.
Like I could, besides right now with the quarantine, like there's weddings all the time. So like DJing weddings is one of my main things, and I usually get booked a lot because I work really well with people and I know how to. Pretty much me and my wife did our own wedding, so I have a lot of experience in that area. So I think I definitely am a real help when I do like DJ weddings, because I have the experience of it too. But yeah, it's kind of what's hitting at the time, whatever. Like right now, because acting is not as prevalent. Same thing with paranormal investigating. I'm doing a lot more music and working on some passion projects, recording albums and working on new albums. But yeah, it's kind of whatever's hitting at the time. Whatever seems to be pulling me in and gets me the most work or gets me the most opportunity is something I really focus on. So I switch focus a lot, but I have a strange thing, and I think it really comes from my abuse. I had to be on top of everything all the time, or else, there was punishments for not being on top of things. And that really taught me this incredible skill of how to balance life. Like, I really get everything done. I'm able to not neglect my wife, but also not neglect my career. So I can spend time with my wife, work on a project, do this, do that, and kind of balance it all. And it works pretty well, where everybody feels like fulfilled, as well as myself being fulfilled working on all these projects. So it really has a lot to do with being able to balance things. So you have to know how to kind of juggle things and make sure you don't neglect certain things that are important, and know what you can kind of put on the back burner for a minute and work on other things.
Nice. So what's on the horizon for you? Do you have any projects that got, like acting projects that got frozen before this pandemic or whatnot? Or is there anything in the future that we should look forward to?
Yeah, definitely. There's a lot. Definitely a lot of projects got pushed back. I was really working hard on my acting career before the quarantine, and I booked quite a few projects that are coming up. And a lot of them look like they're going to start maybe opening up to filming again, maybe August, September. So okay. I know there's a zombie movie I'm going to play a zombie in. We're going to hopefully start shooting in August, September. There's another horror movie I'm going to be in. The director actually and writer wrote a part for me, because since I speak Italian, he wanted more of an international feel to the movie. So he actually wrote a part specifically for me to speak in Italian and kind of do this thing in the movie, as well as get killed. I don't know if I'll get killed. Maybe say Mamma Mia when I die. So,
hey.
Yeah, exactly.
Hey! I'm a dying. I'm a dying right now. Goodbye.
Yeah, I'm a dying.
Hey, Luigi, I'm a dying. Hey. Yeah, exactly.
There's a hole in my chest.
Exactly. So, yeah, there's a comedy side coming out right there. But there's definitely a lot of projects in the future. What I've been doing in the quarantine, which I've seen not a lot of people do, is I didn't want to bring myself down because the opportunities necessarily weren't there. I wanted to try to build for the future when this thing is over, so I had stuff coming up. And luckily, I've made a lot of industry contacts, and there's a lot of possibilities. I have a booker in Florida who wants to fly me out whenever I can to do stand-up comedy out there, and it will be a paid gig. They're going to put me up and everything. But if that goes well, he's actually going to put me on with his tour company and do tours pretty much all around the U.S., doing some stand-up comedy as well. So that may be one of the things that that I may take a lot of time in my life to do, which is great because I love doing stand-up and making people laugh. I'm also working on two albums currently. I just finished recording one album. It's a rap album about injustice. I met a lady through a program I was in who lost her son to gun violence. And there was a lot of things that law enforcement did. They didn't really follow the case and help them, and they really feel like there was an injustice done. and my rap is very socially conscious, so it just clicked. And so I finished recording the project. I plan on releasing it this summer. I'm just working out the details and finishing up mixing and mastering that album.
Wait, are you going to tell me that there's police out there that don't do the right thing?
Yeah, I know this may be shocking, especially in this time.
When did that start?
But yeah, there is.
God, yeah.
Oh, man.
Yeah, I'm a very socially conscious rapper in a lot of ways, and I talk about a lot of social issues, injustice, things like that. But I'm very versatile as well. One of the passion projects I've been wanting to do for a long time that I sat down and wrote most of it, I'm actually doing a whole rap album on the paranormal. So I rap about ghosts, UFOs, extra sensory perception, all that kind of stuff. So I'm really excited about that project, and a future, bigger thing I want to do in the future with this project is do what I call a ghost tour, pun very intended, and tour only haunted venues and do like a VIP experience with my fans where we investigate the haunted venues before or after the show, just to kind of keep that extra element and do something different that I don't think anybody's done before. So I'm really excited about that. I have a few really big industry people who are behind that project that once we're really in the thick of it and I finish recording and putting it all together, that they're going to support that, and hopefully we're going to turn into something really big. So,
nice.
So those
nice.
Are kind of the main things.
Now, when you're doing this kind of tour with like haunted places, are you trying to like entice the ghosts to come out, or are you trying to provoke them, or is it just, hey guys, there could be ghosts in here, don't freak out?
I mean, everybody feels different about the subject. There's believers, there's non-believers. There's the whole spectrum of people who have different beliefs on the paranormal. So it's hard to say. I can tell you the way I approach it is I always tell people that I humanize the experience. So I'm very respectful when I go in and deal with supernatural things, because you never know what you're going to encounter. And I always treat it like you would treat someone who invited you into your home or onto their podcast. You know, you're respectful and appreciative to the people that invite you in. So that's the way I approach investigating. Now, if we do cases and children are involved and there's negative things happening, I might be a little more aggressive. And I won't necessarily try and provoke, but I do want to try and find out what's going on. And I want to make sure that whatever these things are aren't messing with children or people who might be affected, you know, worse by what's going on. But I definitely approach it with respect, and we definitely try to communicate, but I wouldn't say that I want to like provoke it, because that I think that has a negative connotation to it, and you don't want to, you can make activity worse if something's there and you provoke it and it's already something negative. So like I said, I humanize the experience, and we try to be respectful, but we do try to get reactions or activity to happen by the specific questions we ask, behaviors we portray, things like that.
Any chance the ghost can be like the backup tracks, like the, you can get them to sing on the rap album.
That'd be cool. That's good. I haven't had it happen yet, but we have captured lots of EVPs over our.
That's what I mean. That's what I mean. Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, it would be great. You know, that'd be awesome if I was performing a show and, they decided to back up my track and they liked what I was doing. Maybe you know, ghost hype man for my show. That'd be great. Maybe I'll just do that for fun. Put somebody in the back on a mic with like a creepy voice and just like echo my words.
Boo.
Exactly.
Hired a person from Disney's Haunted House and all right. They got a good voice.
There you go.
Yeah. And John Pierre, we had a great time talking to you. If people want to find out where your projects are once we're out of this and what you're up to, where can they go to find out about you?
Yeah, definitely. Thanks a lot for having me. I had a great time with you guys as well. The main website I use is my personal website called www.mcpierre.com. That's the letter M, the letter C, P-I-E-R-R-E.com. And that's the main website I have. It has links to all my stuff, whether it's music, acting, comedy, the paranormal, has links to all my stuff on there. And I keep it updated with what projects I'm working on releasing, updated music and all that stuff. So that's the best main site. My handle on social media is @talentedid. That's talented with an extra ED. Since I do so much, I made up my own word for who I am, Mr. Talentedid.
All right, that works. Thanks so much, man. Stay safe, and hopefully you're out there soon putting out content.
Definitely. Thanks a lot, guys. Thanks for having me.
Take care, bud. All right, Mike, a twofer. We haven't done this in forever. A two guests. Remember when we were doing threefers at one point?
I think that only happened once. We did
the President's Day special. That had three.
Yep. You called me there, and I think one other before we might have. Or maybe it was like two people together then after the initial guest. But
yeah, we didn't have much idea what we were doing.
No. But, you know, this is like coupon day for everybody. Everybody's like, oh, I came in just for like a loaf of bread. But it's like, wait a minute. I get two loaves of bread for the same price? Hook me.
Right.
That's the way I roll.
It's like just when you thought Scott forgot about us the last two Thursdays, just when you thought, oh, they don't care about the Thursday audience.
Yeah.
I came back and was like, look, here's two episodes in one, basically. So I'm really just giving back to the people, which is what we do here, right?
Yeah. We're community podcasts here. Mm-hmm. So what you want, we deliver.
That's all right. Brother, what do you got? What do you got?
I thought we were using the old one.
Oh, no. Yeah, we're already after them, too.
Oh. I'm looking at you like, tonight we have a guy.
Are we doing a threefer that you didn't tell me about? Damn it, Brennan. Let me know what's going on.
Damn these production meetings. They never occur correctly. So I think I brought this up on the podcast before, but
you were offered another threesome.
Okay. I mean, dare to dream, fingers across. You know, maybe the wifey's changed, but we'll just keep that at one for the moment.
If you guys don't know what I'm referencing, you got to go back like three episodes. Berto tells this ridiculous story about him being offered to be swing with one of his old friends.
Yeah, well,
it's insane.
Old coworkers, yeah.
Well, once they ask you to swing and you don't want to, they're not friends anymore.
I was very cordial. I kept talking to him. I even like scrolled through. I apparently wished him a happy Thanksgiving and Christmas. he didn't. All he said was thanks. You know, I guess he was still a little sore by the fact that I didn't make his wife sore. But I digress.
Yeah, well,
but. But I think I brought this up before about me and my wife having this little game where we try to scare each other when we walk into the house.
Yes.
Brought this up before?
You have.
Yeah. So, she got a little upset with me a couple nights ago, you know. And it wasn't me attempting at the beginning. So, we kind of took a break from it for a while. I mean, mainly because... You know, I'm working from home. It's impossible to kind of do that stuff or whatever. But
so you guys were like, look, we're working from home right now. We got to stop playing dead for each other. We got to focus on things here. You know, no more.
There's a pandemic going on. We don't need all this heart racing stuff. We gotta have a truce for a little while.
You're a good guy. Great guy.
Yeah. But, so the wifey, I started having to go back to the office a little bit, a couple times during the week. And about a week ago, she got me. I'm usually good at it, too, because, like, I'll open the door. You know, Callie will come up. I'll say hi to her. And most of the time when she's not attempting anything, she'll be like, hey, honey, like, yelling from somewhere in the house or whatever. So when it's quiet, when the dog comes in, I'm usually prepared, and I start like looking through the crack of the door to see if I see her behind the door or something like that.
So this is pretty serious. So like, yeah. Would you say like, how many times do you think you guys have tried this?
Oh, like easily, I think both of us got each other at least like 20 times.
Wow. Okay. So this is very frequent. Yeah.
Yeah, we were very frequent with this game. And it kind of little died down because, you know, with this going on, plus, like, as we move down here, there's less opportunities where we're both out at the same time or we're not sure when the other one's in or whatever. But
less opportunity to fake death in Georgia than New Jersey, you know?
So she got me one day. And it's like, all right. good. You're good. And then, like, the next day I came home, I did some grocery shopping. And I rarely go to the back door because it's locked most of the time. But when I got a big thing of groceries, it's a shorter trip. And as I opened up, she got, like, pissed off because she was on the stairs. She was going for 2 days in a row, which is a rarity. And she's like, I hate you. I had you ready. I was set up.
Okay.
So she got, I mean, she wasn't upset, but she's like, dang it. I was going for the twofer. Next day comes. I open the door. Callie comes up to me. Hi, Callie. How you going? I notice that silence. I'm like, all right. We're playing our game right now.
Right.
She, now,
First off, stop right now. Like, I fear the day that one of you has an actual medical problem and you're just like, you're playing. You're like, and like, she's like watching a Disney movie while you're dead on the ground. Just, she's like, you're doing really well, babe. And, you know, after I finish all of Fantasia, I'll check in on you.
Yeah. I feel when we're retired and we're in that Florida community, like, it's going to be very awkward calling that ambulance. Yeah. I really.
Yeah.
But, so I know, like I said, I, you know, sensing the situation, I'm like, okay. So I look through the crack and she's nowhere to be found there.
Right.
So I start thinking and I realize when she's usually not there, she'll be behind the couch where I may not be thinking, just keep on walking through the house and give me a scare like that. So I did the ultimate reversal on her where I didn't go straight into the house. I kind of went to the side through the living room as she's like kneeling behind a couch and I booed her in her attempt to boo me. And then she got like really upset. She's like, that's not fair.
So you countered her scare with your own scare.
Yeah. It's kind of, in football terms, it was a pick six.
That,
she was on offense and it's like, oh, nope, I'm scoring.
Hey, all is fair in the game of scaring your significant other to death. That's the rules. Yeah.
Yeah. Like she almost took out my dad once. I think I brought it up on the podcast before. But if I didn't, it's just a reminder. So when we were living with my parents for a little bit before we got our house, she was preparing to do that. So I got home. I actually pulled up in the driveway, and she was staking me out. Like my dad had a security system, so she was like actually watching the monitor for when my car was pulling up to prepare for the scare. What she didn't realize was, which never happens, my dad was on the porch and he actually went the other way, because usually don't go the other way because we had like a dog gate so Callie wouldn't roam around. So he went over the gate and he opened the door and as I'm getting out of my car and I'm getting my computer and all, I hear her scream boo, and like my dad just apparently gave her the look of death and he went back outside and he wouldn't talk to her for a week.
I also want to be there for the apologies. Like, I'm so sorry I scared you, Mr. Berlew. Like,
well, normally he would have probably laughed it off. There was a point my dad was in a really grumpy mood while we were there. Not even to go through the whole stories there. And I mean, he's all good now and everything, but it was just kind of funny because like my brother was also there at the time, my mother, and they were laughing their ass off. And like Izzy was so, she's like, I feel so bad. Then I come in the house and she starts slapping me like, why did you do that? Why did you make me scare your dad? And it's our cute little game. And I know eventually
it's going to end badly.
I'm hoping for her to start going out again so I can start getting back at her where it's more natural, the offense, where I can prepare for her.
Well, I mean, how far do you want to take it? You could start bringing us involved. I could send ransom letters to the house. I could be an anonymous 911 call if you want. Like,
Well, you can't go too far because you got to remember, another thing I kind of brought up before, my wife has an unnatural fear of serial killers, and the fact that, like, she still fears that, Ted Bundy might have had a child, and that child is living the legacy of Ted Bundy.
Oh, that's a really rational thought.
Yeah, it's very, there was one night here, I think it was, the first, month we moved into the new house, and it was, it was warm, but it wasn't, crazy warm where, you put on the air conditioning, so I'm like, all right, I'm gonna open up the window, and she's panicking, and she's, you can't leave the window open, somebody's gonna crawl in the house. I'm like, nobody's coming into the house. And then she's literally like, well, what is it, Ted Bundy shows up on her porch and sees the open window? And I'm like, so the serial killer Ted Bundy would sit back and say, all doors are closed and windows are closed, I can't do anything.
Right.
Oh, wait a minute. One open window, it's murdering time.
One time I was in the Adirondacks in a cabin. We went up for the weekend or whatever. And we're sitting on the bed, and I'm laying back, just kind of chilling, falling asleep. And then I don't know what went through my mind. I kind of was just pretending I was dead, and I really stuck in and was like, oh, I'm going to be dead for a while. And my wife was like, babe. And I didn't stop there. I just kind of still played dead. And she was like, I started crying. I never felt worse in my life, man. And then I was like, oh, I'm just joking. She was so mad at me. It was not a good look. So I don't play those games too much anymore.
See, I think you should have went all out. Even as she calls 911, the ambulance shows up. You just have a little business card in your hand, dude.
ScottPlaysDead.com.
Just be we're playing a game. Just pronounce me dead. Oh. And just go full out. Set up your funeral while you're playing in the wooden box and she's bawling.
Just get all the way into
tell your family. Because
get all the way into the body bag and just sit up on the stretcher and be
you have somebody in the back somewhere like behind bushes or whatever, and has a boom box with the Undertaker's theme song. So the second it's all right, at 5 o'clock you hit that button and Alex is going to hear that bong, and I'm just going to stand up.
See, but that would be the problem. She'd be like, why is Mike standing behind a couch with a boombox laughing maniacally?
we tried it before and it didn't work. That's why I said get another friend. I can't stop chuckling.
I only have so many friends that would do that, and you're by so many I mean you. So that's kind of it.
Well, that's sometimes half the joke. It's like the surprise party that you guys threw for me. I kind of knew it was coming, but it's still kind of cool. It would be the same thing where Alex is bawling or whatever, and then she'll kind of look over and she's like, "Is that Burlew with a big old Samsung boombox over there? Oh, you guys!"
I just picture you in the corner of the room with a lampshade on your head, trying to be a lamp.
I got a flashlight under here in case she pulls the power cord.
Well, on that note, don't kill your wife. Don't scare your wife to death. But it is time to go. I hope you enjoyed our twofer tonight. Two guests. Burlew, anything to promote before we get on out of here?
Speaking of guests, I'm going to promote a book of a former guest, Elizabeth Pipko.
I was going to do the same thing. Not tonight, but yeah, go ahead.
But she's putting a book out called Finding My Place, Making My Parents' American Dreams Come True. It's coming out in August 25th, but you can pre-order it now on Amazon. So check it out. Elizabeth was a guest, I would say, about a good 2.5 years ago or something like that.
She's a model and a poet and a writer. So,
if you listened to the episode, she was a very interesting guest. And again, if you're in the mood, check out her book. It's called Finding My Place.
All right. Now I will promote a friend of mine from college has this amazing woodworking studio. The only reason I'm bringing it up again, because he just posted this picture of like this custom living room furniture set. It's unbelievable. Like the minute I showed it to my wife, she was like, oh my God, can we do that? I'm like, well, not now because we can't afford that. But his work is unbelievable. It's just all custom work, really, really nice stuff for reasonable prices. And he does it all himself from the ground up. He builds everything custom made to whatever size you need, and really great stuff. He is under the name Black Bear Woodwork on Facebook, and they're out of Oak Ridge, New Jersey. So Black Bear Woodwork, check them out. His stuff is pretty unbelievable. So
Bear News.
Oh, and Black Bear Woodwork.com. So that's it, guys. Best thing you can do for us, if you like the show, is leave us a review and share it with your friends and catch us on all the various podcast platforms we're at. And that's it, guys. Life is funny. Laugh at it. Keep the wind at your back. See you next week. Bye-bye.
We still love you, dude, Jack. Don't kill us.